Jay Brown, and my specialty is occupational medicine, and I started a database of toxicology about 1991 when the first Access came out, and I just thought it was, you know, I became interested in medical information and putting it in a relational database. And HAZMAP is chemicals, hazardous chemicals for the worker, and also occupational diseases. And occupational diseases include infectious diseases. So right away I was into infectious diseases, and then I continued that with two other databases that I've made in the last 10 years, I guess. And my disclosure is that that I have developed two infectious disease applications for PDAs, and these are available for sale through the U.S. Biomedical Information Systems. So my outline is, what is the public health problem and what is the medical informatics problem? What is the concept of knowledge mapping? What is an intelligent database? And is it time to be exhaustive? And I see the public health problem is, as we mentioned in the introduction of the first session, about one half of all deaths in poor countries are caused by infectious diseases. And this is in David Heyman's introduction to the CCDM. So this is a startling statistic. And of course, we know that infectious diseases are no longer confined by geographical boundaries. You can have SARS in China one day, and then the next week you can have it in Canada. So this is the public health. That's what I see as the public health problem. And there's no easy fix for global health. You know, we're talking about quick access to summarize up-to-date infectious disease information, but this is just one of many requirements. When you get in these poor societies, there's other requirements are adequate food, water, sanitation, housing, education, human rights, and access to health facilities. I mean, so this is can be very challenging, getting this information out where it can be used. And I found this paper, which I liked, especially the figures 1 and 2, where they talk about the global and global health and some of these other factors that that come into play. So I recommend that article if you're interested more about these other requirements. And I see the medical informatics problem as being an explosion of information about infectious diseases. You know, what did we know about infectious diseases 100 years ago? And what do we know to now? It's amazing that all the knowledge that we have, but it can be a problem because how can we find the specific information when we need it? So it kind of comes, we talk about the public health problem and then the informatics problem. You put together, it's we need a public health informatics solution using the available technology, indexing and mapping the wealth of information, creating an intelligent database to store the information in such a way that specific information can be easily retrieved, and using the internet to disseminate this information for improvement of medical practice and prevention. In public health, we talk about the surveillance cycle. And so you have a, you know, what we want to do is we want to control and prevent the disease. That's the action that we want to get to. And so we do what we can and we collect some data on this. We look at what it is and then we cycle that back through the people that are affected with statistics about the disease. And then we again back control and vent. So it's an iterative, continuous process of improvement. And I would suggest, you know, now we're coming into ability where we can index and map that information. We can map it in a relational database, and then we can disseminate it on the internet. So this is two kind of new parts of the medical surveillance, kind of e-surveillance, electronic surveillance, that's electronic medical surveillance that allows us to improve this process. And relational databases, I don't know how many of you are familiar with Access and what these databases can do, but very powerful tools. Like a company database, where you put in the employees, you have a table of employees, a table of customers, products, invoices, and you have this, all this, all these tables are linked together in a very smart way, so you can store all this information and get this information. And this is what we can do with the relational database that we didn't have before. You say it was 1991 when Access first came out. Before that, there was nothing really that we could do this with. And I think you started with Paradox, didn't you, Steve?
Yeah, Quantum Pro and Keybase 3.
So indexing is done first by developing a controlled vocabulary specific for the knowledge domain. And the knowledge domain here is infectious diseases. Knowledge domain for HAZMAP is really occupational toxicology. So whatever the knowledge domain is, you have to develop specific vocabulary that has to do with the symptoms and the exposures. And you put this, the indexes come first. A book, the indexes come last. But when you're looking, when you want to do queries for information and find information by a relational database, the indexes have to go in first. And then you do the queries allowing finding information by search criteria, the indexes. And you can do, most commonly, we do the AND searches. And then we use categories to drill down to find information. And very simply, AND queries, you have all the diseases, one red circle with a finding rash, all diseases with a finding cough, so you have two circles, and the overlap is rash and cough. So this is something you could do mechanically. You could make a list of all the diseases, write them down, make another list, and then you can look at them and see, okay, which one are in both? But the computer can do this instantaneously. This is what queries are. This is the power of using a relational database. Indexing is, we talked about the importance of indexing, and it's really, what is indexing? It's really at the heart of intelligence. No intelligence system is likely to function effectively if it cannot find out what it needs when it needs to know it. And so you can use those indexes to show all the diseases that match one or more criteria. Central Africa and a petechial rash. A rash is a type of purple or red marks that blanch on pressure. It's a specific type of rash that's seen, usually from a low platelet count, cat contact and diarrhea, tick exposure, anemia. So these are some of the queries that you can do to make the differential diagnosis smaller. And I'm not sure I'm going to try to go out there or not, but I guess we'll try here as far as coming back. But that's pretty fast going out. This is a slide I have on outbreak ID. And so we have categories of infectious diseases that I came up with. And those numbers are the number of diseases in each category. And we have the different findings that I'm using for in this particular database, and the categories of a lot of neurological, skin, and even respiratory, and even chest X-ray findings. And then, so I can see it right here, it's much easier. And I use this syndromes for outbreak ID, where you can actually use these categories of syndromes to put the diseases, for example, acute neurological plus fever, which I abbreviated neuro plus. The plus means there's fever. Neuro minus means this is a syndrome where there's neurological symptoms, but there's not a fever. And then you can group these diseases in which this syndrome is most common. And it's a way of looking, not only for infectious diseases, but also diseases of bioterrorism, where we're looking at a syndrome that you see, and you want to know what are the possibilities that in that particular syndrome. And then endemic, where there's, I'm using regions of the world and 16 regions of the world rather than specific countries. And epidemiological factors, for example, an entry, how does the organism get into the body? By ingestion or through a needle? What is the source? Is it from a patient or is it from a fecal-oral contamination? What's the vector? Is it a tick or a mosquito? And what are the reservoirs? What are the animals that carry the disease? Now, Alt-Tab to get back, maybe. Well, that worked pretty good. So, examples of AND queries on the web. I'll just show you one. So this is the this is HAZMAP, which is on the web free on the National Library of Medicine website. And so you can look up occupational infections and brucellosis. And this shows the disease format for brucellosis. Where you have the synonyms, the categories, the incubation, diagnostic, and then followed by the symptoms in alphabetical order. And the hazardous job tasks we'll discuss later that are related to that infection, brucellosis. to show you to do a search by jobs and symptoms, we can find veterinarian, and what are we looking at? Encephalitis, I think. Neurological. Let's see, what is the complication? Let us say stiff neck is the thing I was wondering. Stiff neck, okay. So and then so on based on those two criteria, we can do an AND search and just kind of bring down the list of occupational infections to those that fit both. A veterinarian is likely to be exposed because of the work he does, because of the type of exposure he has to animals. And these are all the ones that could cause a stiff neck. That's an example of doing queries on the web. Other examples are a registered nurse with hemoptysis, registered nurse with a liver function test, an abnormal liver function test. We're talking about the internet. It's an interesting look at the growth of the internet, and starting with 1998, we're going to watch the internet spread around the world. These are 31, the percent of people online. So here we have 31% down to 0 to 5, the really light colored ones. So this is where we were in 1998, and we're going to watch this spread around the world here. 2000, 2001, 2002, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and that's as far as they have it on this site, just showing this powerful technology that we have. And my job is to pull information together from the best available sources. I use textbooks and CDC website, WHO website, journal articles, but I rely a lot for infectious disease. I rely a lot on the current editions of the major infectious disease textbooks, is what I'm, and of course, CCDM is the, you know, the current edition of CCDM is probably my, where I start, you know, with my, the diseases and so forth that I'm going to put in there. And there's a bibliography page on Outbreak ID, which shows the tags that I have for my sources of information. And so ABX Guide, CCDM, CDC Travel, D-Explain, and some of these major textbooks, Garant. And so the in my database, all of the, I try to document all of the findings with a reference. And then when there's a new edition, I have to go back and check all those references, see if there's any change. Knowledge mapping. Interesting to think about map of 1570 compared to the Google map of today, and we have a little more accuracy here. This is supposed to be South America, but it's amazing how much they did know less than 100 years after Columbus. And and this information comes from the first marine explorers. And it's an example of, you know, they are pulling information from multiple sources to put this map together, wherever, you know, whichever people they could get information from. And sometimes, you know, maybe the information wasn't too reliable, but they had to rely on what they had to make the map. And it also reminds us that maps don't have to be perfect to be useful. So we can still, maybe we don't have perfect information now, but we can still try to do the best we can to help help guide us. And that maps become more useful with time. As you get more information, you get better maps. Decision support systems can provide preliminary analysis that allows scarce human resources to focus on the key problems while ignoring a vast sea of irrelevancy. So that's one of the kind of the definition of what you're trying to do with a decision support system. You're kind of bringing this information that people would be looking for, but they don't have to take the time to look for it. You've already looked for it for them and made it easy for them to find it. You can define knowledge as the information in context. Mapping means pulling together and sifting information from a lot of different sources. Knowledge mapping is comprehensively collecting and systematically indexing a knowledge domain. It begins with the big picture. And the concept when you're knowledge mapping, you start, if you're going to map a country, you start with a continent, with the mountains, with the coastlines, with the main rivers, the big cities. So you start with the big picture first, and then you put the details in the context of that big picture. So this is the concept I've used with HazMap and with my databases, and it's trying to see the big picture first and then put the details in there, and not get lost, so you don't get lost in the details. You keep the information in context of the whole. You're distilling, which is, you know, what you're doing with your work, is a lot of distilling type work. And most useful, this type of knowledge mapping is most useful in information intensive specialties like infectious diseases and toxicology. It was just, no doctor can hold all that information in their brain. They have to have they have to look it up. So this is three pictures from the Google map, and we're going to zoom in, and finally we're going to see this city of Genoa. And so we zoom in and zoom out is the concept of mapping information. And this was a concept of Parse and Chignell that I read early in the 90s. Intelligent databases are databases that manage information in a natural way, making information easy to store, access, and use. And here are some important search criteria that you can use when you're looking for, you have a case and you have a finding and you know where a particular part of the world, or you know what the, you expect it's coming from birds, or you have a, you know, that's, you know, whatever information you have, you're using that to bring down the differential diagnosis to make it a shorter list. And these are these examples of categories of the findings, and I use this abbreviation that allows them to, when you sort the findings, then they all occur in their category. So the complications, I got the complications sort at the end. I'll show an example of this later if we have time. And I made up a name for this called Zoom Intersection. It's a little bit different than, It's a little bit different than putting a case in, which Steve's software is using. It's more the idea of trying to, you know, figure out, okay, what do I know about this case that is really critical? I mean, things like fever and myalgia are not too useful because almost every disease has them. But if you can get key into some of these, you know, like you know what the job was, or you know that it was a needle stick, or you know that, you know, some of these more specific types of findings, you know, that there was an increased number of eosinophils in the blood. And then the syndromes, we talked about that, are if you know that it's, you know, suspecting a intentional attack. So this describes the idea of Zoom Intersection. These are the tables in the database. Now, one of my database has jobs and one doesn't. So when you're doing jobs, you have the intermediary job task, a hazardous job task, say working with animals. Some professions have that as a hazardous job task, and that ties them into certain diseases that are spread in that way. And then these are the findings, the signs and symptoms, and this means that there's a many-to-many relationship. So you look at one finding and you can see all the diseases that are linked to that finding. You can look at one disease and you can see all the findings of that disease. So this is something that you can, if you want to do it yourself, you know, access. You can put these tables together and make this make your own database. Each table has in one of these databases there are 201 diseases, so there's 201 records in the disease table, 135 findings, 101 job tasks, and 102 jobs. We talked about the high risk job tasks. What are the specific job tasks that put the workers at risk for the disease? And we're going to see some of these. First ones here, I'll start out with a lot of types of animal exposures. And so each one of these can be linked to different jobs. And I also link to specific diseases. So and then we get down into some medical job tasks, ones that would be important for any medical workers would have these types of job tasks. Another medical, and then we're getting into some dust exposures, type of farmers and so forth that are exposed to dust, water exposure, travel exposure, and then exposure to insects. And then finally, these are more exposures by eating, would not really be more, these would be more activities than job tasks that any consumer could be exposed to the disease. Finally, is it time to be exhaustive? Have we reached that point yet? I don't know. This is common to see this. This comes from a chapter in Cohen, which is one of the authors of one of the standard textbooks of infectious diseases. And he has a chapter on jaundice and a returned traveler from Nepal. And he says, potential infectious causes of jaundice are listed in this table. This is not meant to be exhaustive. And that's kind of a common, you know, it's like, well, why can't, maybe it's time to be exhaustive. You know, why can't we find all these because he's saying that he's only doesn't have all of them in there, because he hasn't taken the time to try to find out what they all are. And in the table, he shows 8 viral, 11 bacterial, and 4 parasitic causes of infectious diseases that can cause jaundice and would could occur in Nepal. Now, it's interesting, I did a search on CCDM, just a, you know, a text search, and I found that 10 viral, 2 bacterial, and 4 parasitic. And my little database, IDDX, I found 37 of them with the symptom jaundice. But if you look at my region of India and South Asia, there was only 12 viral, 14 bacterial, and 10 parasitic. So still. And then finally, we look at Steve's database, Gideon, 50 come up in Nepal, 13 viral, 26 bacterial. Many of these were rickettsial, and 8 parasitic. So if sometime we're gonna have to get together and try to make these lists, put our heads together and make these lists as perfect as we can, and really be exhaustive. Let's have an exhaustive list. I mean, this is important information. I mean, why can't you come up with a most accurate list possible of all the diseases that cause jaundice in this country, and using all the resources? And I think Steve has put more effort into that than anybody at this point. But we'll see where we go from there. See, I still have a couple minutes. this is the concept of what is decision support? What is a decision support software? What is its purpose? And I think it's not decision replacement. We're not trying to replace the human being. I don't think artificial intelligence will ever beat human intelligence, and that we're trying to have a tool here that will help the professional do his job. And do his job better. But some of the pitfalls, you have to list some of the pitfalls that you have when using a software, and you look it up and it doesn't come up. Why doesn't it come up? There's a number of reasons. And this happens not only in doctors using software, but doctors who don't use software, because more than one disease may be causing the symptoms. You're looking for one disease, but maybe it's, maybe that jaundice is caused by this person has a gallstone stuck in his common duct, and he also has an infectious disease. So the cause of the fever may be non-infectious. So you're looking for this infectious disease that's not an infectious disease. It's some kind of lymphoma or something. Symptoms may be missed or wrongly named, and this can happen at the time that the diagnosis is made, where the person comes in the emergency room and they call the symptom wrong, or they miss the symptom. And the same can happen in the doctors of infectious disease who write up chapters about these diseases. They miss something, or they misname something. Symptoms may be due to a complication of the infection rather than the infection itself. And diseases may be endemic to only one part of a region or a country. So you're looking for a endemic disease, but it's only in one particular area of that country. So I think that situation awareness for the professional is critical for making the proper diagnosis with or without decision support software. And there is a paper I published this year on using a relational database to index infectious disease information, which I covered this material today, but if you're looking for a written form of that. So I think use my time up, right? And we can, we're gonna gather now for a panel here where we can answer questions, maybe have some discussion about this. So I tried to put together maybe this might stimulate some questions. These are what do we call them? The goals or the...
The learning objectives.
Learning objectives, yes. These are the learning objectives of each of the speakers today. And I think, Paul, you kind of answered this question about what is your process for distilling and summarizing the information so that it is useful and readable. And that's one of your kind of central things of your project, isn't it? Central goals.
Yeah, we decided not to be comprehensive. And we sort of artificially used a limited number of lines to sort of force that conciseness. And we have chosen authors and reviewers that deal with these diseases, so that people have a lot of clinical experience. So it's not just taking epi information and organizing. These are generally written by people that may not be authorities in their field, but certainly deal with these common questions all the time. So what we try to do is give some insight there. We often use this term clinical pearls, what kind of things might be tip-offs, and then really try to gauge and deal with what we think are the frequently asked questions, help with the differential diagnosis of commonly other considered entities. But we tend not to have something as sophisticated as what Steve or even Jay has, because what we want to do is just give enough information, and then we have the people that are reading this do their clinical relationships, and then can click on diseases and go back and forth and find extra information at that time. They're not really presented with anything. So it depends on them drilling in to the information, which is probably, we think, how most clinicians usually think when they're trying to find out information.
You have several faculty, and also you have your fellows work on this?
We have fellows, faculty. We're not just limited to Johns Hopkins, so we have, I think, authors from about 21 different institutions.
Oh, that's great.
So it's fairly widespread there. Many of those had at one time trained at Hopkins, so I can't claim that they don't have any Hopkins jobs.
That's kind of a new way of, it's really a completely new way of publishing, isn't it? I mean, you go back to the standard textbook of infectious diseases. I mean, it's a different, completely different process.
Well, and for any of those who are thinking about doing something on their own, it is a new model. And I have to say, medical publishing, the publishers still don't know what to do with this, because they're used to a print model with lots of editorial oversight and support staff and so on. And they often have this model of giving 10% royalties, and you can't run this project very well in that kind of model. But then other new electronic publishers, we do it in-house, but Unbound Medicine is one that you've heard, have a very different model. It's lower cost. You supervise your own editorial oversight. They merely give you the electronic structure. And they may have royalties of 35 to 50%, or they can do contract work, so if you have a grant or something like that, to do that. We found our own costs substantially decreasing. I don't know if you found that as well. But technology costs are going down, so what cost a fair amount in 5-6 years ago now is probably half for us as well.
Yes, no question.
Hi, I'm Linda Borgonski, from the Yale Manhattan Center for Healthcare Solutions. We've mostly been the Center for Emergency and Disaster Response, so we're kind of heading into more of a new role, but encompassing emergency preparedness. And I say that because, I'm sorry, I missed your presentation. I caught the end of yours, I was at another one, but I'm working on a project that we're doing at the office with the U.S. NORTHCOM here in Colorado Springs. And one of the tasks that we're doing for next year is to kind of put together a consensus of all the epi modeling that's going on for infectious disease, kind of on a disaster basis. So what are the models that are out there for infectious diseases that could be somewhat related to terrorism or... So we're working closely with the military, so kind of a civilian-military basis. But I'm trying to gather names and information to have people act as advisors for this task. We've got
some people from DC that are helping us on more local military employment, but I'd like to get your cards if I could. But is epi modeling, or do you find that there are so many different models out there that that's some of the discussion that we've already had, that, you know, what are the models that you look at and on a national basis, you know, and if there's a huge disaster going coming and infectious disease is spreading, you know, who are the models, where are the models that we go to?
I presented one, I don't know if you were here.
No, I missed that.
Actually, they have it in Yale, you might be able to get online there and see it, Guinean Geo.
Okay.
I don't know if they still, they were using it. Now, part of it's a decision support system that I've been working with. You could say there is a suspected bioterror event, mm-hmm. put in signs and symptoms, and it gives you a rank differential diagnosis, that's what it does.
Okay.
So
that's what I'm looking at.
Kind of, and it's pretty exhaustive, it's, you know, it's got all the diseases.
But it is tricky because you have plague in the United States, but if you're in Maryland and there's about a plague, you're coming from Fort Detrick, and you know. Whereas if you're in New Mexico or Lyme disease, you know, in Maryland, I can tell you if you're in a western county, it's much less likely to be Lyme disease than in an eastern county.
That brings up another
malaria the same way.
Granularity in all these systems. In my system, if you put in a fever and a cough, you come up with, among other things, coccidioidal mycosis. But if you're speaking of someone in, you know, your areas, it's not on the list. Because we can't do it state by state. It could be done, it's just a huge amount. And having done it state by state, we'd have to do it state by state for India and for Venezuela. They also have states. Waliyats in Yemen, you know, like it's endless to split these up. Even in the state, as you say, Western versus, or city versus country, or summer versus winter, you know.
But local practitioners would know that, but wouldn't know it is the guy in Montana seeing someone that just came from Western Maryland and he wouldn't know.
So who, I mean, do you, for specific models that are out there, for, you know, these epi models that are out there across the United States, I mean, just thinking about them now, can you think of, you know, two or three that are out there that say, yeah, that's where the government should go to, you know, who's the best person to go to? Of course, if you're Johns Hopkins, you're going to say, well, come to Johns Hopkins.
No, I mean, I would say the Centers for Disease Control. I mean, they really, you know, if you think about Lyme disease, they have a map with every dot on there, and you could just easily get to a pixel relationship there. You know, they'll have state-by-state information on reportable diseases, but if it's not reportable, then I think that's the difficulty. But everything for bioterrorism is reportable, so you're safe.
Is your focus on bioterrorism, biothreat agents specifically, or is it broader than that?
It's broad. I think it's infectious disease. So we're looking at, because when I first started working on this, and the test didn't exactly say what, we kind of decided, okay, we're going to look at infectious disease first. Then kind of it kind of started traveling from there.
I think you almost have to look at what your major targets are, because influenza, I would tell you to go to flu booth. Which is a CDC website that's updated almost in real time, for example. Whereas if you're, I don't know, looking up coccidioides, for example, you know, you're going to go to some paper that was compiled in the last year.
Well, the CDC is having an epi modeling conference at the beginning of this month, so I think that should probably open a few more doors.
I mentioned for bioterrorism, Weinstein. This book here, number 44, Biological and Chemical Terrorism. And he divides basically into different syndromes and what are the possible agents that cause the syndromes. And he covers, you know, if you talk, you know, there's also chemical agents, and some of these, you know, some of these chemical agents are toxins can cause fever and look like infectious disease. So it's like if you're going to really look at it, you almost have to look at some of the chemicals as well. And that's what I did with Outbreak ID, which is a database, you know, that I published. And Outbreak ID, I put it together after 9-1-1 with the idea that, you know, why don't we have a database that if something happens, we can look at a syndrome and say, what could it be, you know, and include the bioterrorism agents. But, you know, you talk about epidemiology. I mean, there really is no epidemiology. It's just like an attack, you know, that can occur anywhere. And
it's the whole area of bioterrorism. Interesting because it's not the terrorists who outline what's the bioterrorism agents. It's the response community is trying to guess what would be the best. Now, interestingly enough, anthrax is not a very effective biothreat agent, and it's the one that we all are familiar with.
And I think that's right in Connecticut.
Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting is if you look at the anthrax in Florida that Larry Bush identified, it's only because he didn't, you know, he said this is so unusual to see this particular gram stain in the cerebrospinal cord and bloody pleural effusions that he, that those were the two key points for him that drove him to that. And your kind of program might be able to do something like that for someone that isn't as savvy or as informed.
Scott made the point before that the bioterror module is not Bayesian. And the reason is nobody knows how. Intuitively, we know that, well, IgA anthrax is probably more likely than Bolivian hemorrhagic fever, which is also a bioterror agent, but one of the numbers of Europe.
But there is a list of, you know, you can look up a list of bioterrorism agents based on the fact that they could be used, you know, and they could, you know, could cause enough damage and could be used. You know, the CDC has a list, and
yeah,
this book has a list. And
that's why we
you have your list. Yeah.
This question.
A couple comments. I found it fascinating the both sessions this morning, and I see considerable overlap among the different systems that have been developed. And, you know, do you have any sort of suggestions as to, you know, when you're talking about, you know, which system do you look at? Do you look at multiple? If you're, say, the clinician somewhere in a developing country in Africa and trying to sort of sort out what to help you with. because there's pros and cons to all of the systems in terms of some are, as you say, much more comprehensive, some are taking the top 95%. I particularly like the one that was targeted to Zambia, but you can't do that, and it's not always available. You know? So what kind of guidance could you give for somebody who's looking for a general resource, you know, from all the different resources that are now available?
You know, we had dinner last night. We actually got together, and we did talk a little about this.
Uh-huh.
Sadly, it's not just, it's also a matter of where we are, and our system is commercial. I shouldn't say that too loud.
Yeah.
Others are free. You know, each does have these. We'd like to see something. What is the word for eclectic? And, There's another system out there which you're working on, which is it's an information, it's a book. It's by Victor Yu. You know, what's called Anti-Micron, which is amazing. It's just information, but a very exhaustive information on every topic in infectious disease. We'd like to pull that one in too.
Yeah.
We don't have anything near the drug information that you have.
Yeah.
I think it depends on what, you know, I mean, part of the reason the medical record has said you have to use this information system as everybody comes to it differently. For us, we're hoping people will look up information quickly, you know, in a certain context. But if you were a student learning, you might come to our guide, but you might go to Anti-Micro or a textbook. Or if you didn't really know the patient was going from a strange area there, or if you had an outbreak, you'd go here. So it's very hard to know.
Well, I know, and I've used several over my career, you know, different resources, and yet I'm learning about new ones all the time, and it's sort of balancing that, I guess.
Yeah.
I think for the consumer, you being the consumer, it's going to be a challenge going forward because each one of these products have, as you said, their strengths and their weaknesses, and so they have different applicabilities.
Right.
So right now, there isn't a one size fits all.
No, and I'm aware of that.
Might be the next generation to do that, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of information out there. A second question, specifically around the use of all of this technology in developing countries. And I have been in countries where, as you found out in Zambia, there is no internet access. They may not even have a computer. And looking at the map that you put up as to how the internet has spread around the world, and I was looking at Africa as that went, and there were just a few countries that kept, you know, getting darker and darker, and the rest of it was still pretty blank. How do you see that, you know, the small handheld devices is one way. Is that something that to your knowledge, that's being promoted around other countries in Africa? Or is that something that, I mean, this is such a wonderful resource. How do we get it to all the other people that don't have internet access? And my husband has done some work in Yemen, and the people that he works with, some of them have never seen a computer. And yet, they could really use some of the resources that are available.
You know, at least our experience has been the handheld devices have been very useful, but no one's making them now because everyone's making smartphones. So it's actually, I mean, there's still some manufacturers, but that's the sort of thing in the past. And that, you know, for $50 or $99, you could have a powerful handheld computer that was somewhat durable. And you know, the number of those manufacturers have declined because everyone's making smartphones, but the smartphone network is pretty much limited to capital cities. In Africa, a major issue has been internet access. Right now, there are only two main lines coming into the continent. And because of that, the bandwidth is really slim, and that's why there's a lot of outage, even in capital cities. There's a new, I think it's coming from Mombasa, that's supposed to come into Central Africa, but you know, again, it's the capacity is so much less. Satellite is still very expensive, and so on and so forth. So I think static information that can be updated, and that was our philosophy. Yeah. The CD-ROM, you know, if you can get your handheld device to a computer at some point in several months, you insert the CD-ROM, it updates your device. Seems to us the best solution there, along with solar charging.
Well, and they use cell phones all the time. That's how it is.
Yeah.
If you can somehow incorporate that technology into the accessing of information.
Yeah. Datadyne is a winner of last year of Wall Street Journal's Technology Award. Datadyne's based in Washington, D.C. They actually break information up into SMS text messaging. As you know, it can only go to 140, but everyone in Africa has a cell phone. Yeah. But the problem is, you know, you can query the database, but then you get a number of text messages. It's sort of cumbersome, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is sort of an interim solution. So if you were interested and had very specific questions, in fact, something called EpiInfo, I don't know if you're familiar with that, and EpiSurveyor, which is a web-based program, very popular in public health, they have adapted to handheld, so they can actually go out into the field, collect information, and then use that on just a regular cell phone.
Here's a question. How good are the latest editions of CCDM and ID textbooks in keeping us up to date? You know, can I rely on those? Do I have to?
I can't speak for the ID textbooks, but for CCDM, I think as long as it was only in print version, there were issues there in keeping up to date. But I think with the development of an online version now, the intent David has is that there will be some degree of periodicity for updates of the online version.
Oh, that's great.
How frequently that's going to be is not yet to be determined.
Mm-hmm. Paul, what do you think about the textbooks out there?
We're not quite as up to date as Steve because he and his crew is daily. But we certainly, you know, as our jobs allow, follow all the major literature and generally update. Plus, we have topics we tend to update far more frequently that we know, influenza, for example. But again, our level is not as thorough as yours. And it's mainly, is there important enough information that would change a clinical practice? That's our threshold, and then we'll insert that information.
Yeah, I must say, I think how important it is to be updated daily. It's a thing that people have asked us to do. But frankly, most of the stuff that goes in, you know, if you find it out next week, you find it out tomorrow, it's the same thing. You know, people are very interested in the number of cholera cases in Haiti day by day, you know, but they're on the sources of that. They don't have to come to my side.
Right. More and more the textbooks are going online, so where that will go. But at this point, you know, if I rely on this on these textbooks, it's like every 5 years they're updated. But we're kind of entering a new era, you know, with what you're doing with the ABX guide, where something new comes up, you're gonna put it in there in the next month or two.
You know, we tend to use guidelines because we don't have enough horsepower to actually develop our own recommendations. But what we'll do is use faculty that can integrate new information, and therefore a guideline that might be 5 or 6 years old will sort of modify and say this is our suggestion currently, maybe based on the study. We always try to incorporate any randomized controlled trial. So we, every year we'll do a survey of all randomized controlled trials for any drug, specific diagnosis, incorporate that information. But infectious diseases, there's very little that ever shows superiority. It's usually, you know, when you have the immune system and medications, you know, it's not as though it's hypertension or cardiovascular disease. There's a lot of other contributors. So it's probably a little less important, but that's sort of our approach. We use PubMed, and they have a little button for randomized controlled trials, which is very helpful. Under PubMed, there's limits. Yeah. So it'll be human, English. You know, you can have all these limits. Review, meta-analysis. One is for randomized controlled trial.
I have one last question, if nobody else has another one. This is about laboratory diagnosis. We were talking about these microarrays, new technology, and they detect the DNA of the organisms, right? The PCR, and maybe in the future integrating this with, you know, with databases, with decision support. And so you kind of limit the diagnosis, you know, from the beginning, rather than trying to find anything possible. What are you looking for? You're looking for, you know the vector, or you know the country. You put that in, and then you limit it down. Then you put the microarray on that. I don't think that anybody's doing that yet, but it seems like that would be an area that's got to go into. So eventually we'll get the, like the tricorder with Dr. McCoy, and, you know, just there's your diagnosis. I mean, have you heard of these microarrays? Have you heard of those?
Yeah. I think the application of this, though, is not universal. That's the problem. I mean, there are some. That's why I sit in the laboratory supplement that we're talking about, CCDM. We're going to talk about laboratories and settings being able to identify what their level of capability is. So even though we have some highly sophisticated laboratory procedures and techniques coming out, there are still some issues with doing those and carrying those out in a setting where the quality is not there and the conditions are not right to really ensure good outcomes. So I did a study once 20 years ago about how many mistakes you could make doing a dipstick and a simple elimination test, and it's amazing. So and even the simplest procedures can be done incorrectly. So yeah. That's a problem.
Yeah. Any more questions for us, or shall we close for the day? Is that a good idea? Thanks for coming.